is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Swuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It becomes a treacherous cycle, and it is a reminder that, you know, in democracies, there are always problems, but you have a means to try to resolve the problems, and you want to use those legal means to do so rather than relying on a military action, which in, by definition is extra-constitutional.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies on how military coups undercut democracy. Details coming up. Also, there are growing calls in South Africa for the government to make vaccinations mandatory. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, planned to convene a virtual summit today to discuss the coup that ousted Guinean President Alpha Condé on Sunday. Some countries have mentioned possible sanctions. Condé's decision to change the constitution, which allowed him to run for a third term that he won last year, fueled discontent, as did a struggling economy. Dozens died in election violence. The streets of the capital have largely returned to normal, and at least 80 political prisoners detained by Condé were released yesterday evening. Coup leader Mamadi Doumbouya, a former French legionnaire, has pledged to install a transitional government of national unity, but has not said when or how. The constitution and the government have been dissolved. Guinea's landmark 2010 election gave its people hope for democracy after decades of corrupt dictatorship in the West African country. Instead, President Alpha Condé modified the constitution so he could stick around for a third term. That prompted violent street protests in the capital, Conakry, last year and ultimately made him vulnerable to a military coup. Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, discussed the potential scenarios ahead with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
It is true that Condé stayed on controversially for a third term in violation of the Constitution. And even then, several of the Electoral Commission members and members of his own cabinet resigned in protest. And so there are serious issues with how he has governed, and these merit more attention by ECOWAS, the African Union, and the international community. Nonetheless, these actions don't justify a military coup. Coups are highly destabilizing for any country, and if nothing less, they are taking the country off of a constitutional path, and therefore it effectively leaves it up to the coup makers to decide when and how they'll return power and what sort of governance arrangements they will follow. Now, this just creates a terrible precedent, because if we give the coup makers that sort of authority, then what's to stop the next group of colonels from deciding that they're not happy with how a government's being run, and then they declare a coup and justify it, the fact that the government isn't being well run. So it becomes a treacherous cycle, and it is a reminder that, you know, in democracies, there are always problems, but you have a means to try to resolve the problems, and you want to use those legal means to do so rather than relying on a military action, which in, by definition is extra constitutional to do so. And I think that's the real crux of the challenge we're seeing in Guinea today.
The African Union typically suspends the membership of a country after a coup, and in West Africa, former colonizer France still carries a lot of economic clout and can also impose targeted sanctions. Are the African Union, the international community, and the Guinean people going to accept this coup?
Well, I think it's too soon to say. You know, up until last year, there was a fairly universal reaction when we would see a coup, where there would be a widespread condemnation and an unwillingness to recognize coup leaders. If you think back to the 2012 coup in Mali, that's what happened. And eventually the coup leaders there had to give up power. However, last year, we saw another coup in Mali. And in that case, the international community and ECOWAS effectively recognized the coup and has, I think, created a precedent that has opened the door for other military actors to seize power. We saw the death of Idris Deby in Chad. Effectively, the military decided who was going to be his replacement. You know, again, it was highly extra-constitutional action, but it was accepted by the international community. So I think it's an open question about how they're going to react and what sort of pressure is going to be brought onto these coup leaders. I think ECOWAS and the African Union are realizing if they don't take a hard stand, then this is going to become increasingly common. And so I think we're at a really important time right now in Africa about just what sort of commitment there is to civil-military relations and the respect for democracy.
The junta purports to be acting on behalf of the Guinean people and promise to establish a unity government. Will military leaders simply rebrand themselves as civilian candidates in any future elections?
Well, this is a common tactic. The coup leaders will claim that they're acting on behalf of citizens and wanting to restore democracy. However, that's not the way that democracy works. And when individuals in the military mount a coup, they are acting extra legally. And so it isn't up for them to decide, you know, how a transition should happen, how a governance process should work. They don't have that legitimacy. So regardless of what the intentions of these coup leaders are, and I think it's still too soon to say, that's not a viable way forward. And we'll have to see what sort of reaction emerges among the citizens in Guinea. Often with a coup, you'll see some citizens come on the street and support the coup just because they're so frustrated with the current government. Yet within a short period of time, they're often highly disappointed and disillusioned because once a coup is accepted, they're basically making up the rules of the game as they go along. And so I think we'll have to see what happens in Guinea. My observation so far is many citizens are taking a wait-and-see attitude. I don't think they wanted the military to intervene. I think they do want democracy. We'd see massive protest in Guinea trying to prevent Condé from a third term. Guinea has had a long history of military government, and Guinea suffered greatly because of them. Guinea is one of Africa's poorest countries, and it suffered greatly from corruption and human rights abuses at the hands of the military. So I don't believe there's a large segment of the population that is going to support the military as a vehicle for democracy.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with my colleague, Mohamed Al-Shenawi. Sudan summoned the Ethiopian ambassador today to inform him that 29 bodies were found in the Tekeze River, which separates the two countries. A Sudan Foreign Ministry statement says the corpses are Ethiopian from the Tigray ethnic group. It did not say how they died. Dina Mufti, spokesperson for the Ethiopian Foreign Affairs Ministry, did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Meanwhile, a Reuters report says rebel forces from the Tigray region have killed 120 civilians over a two-day period in one village in Ethiopia's Amhara region. War broke out 10 months ago between Ethiopia's federal troops and forces of the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, killing and displacing thousands and causing widespread severe hunger. The UN and the US and others are pressing for an immediate ceasefire and a path to talks to end the conflict. As South Africa prepares for a fourth wave of COVID-19, there are growing calls for the government to make vaccinations mandatory. But the calls are opposed by a loud anti-vaxxer lobby group. These are people who for a variety of reasons do not believe in immunizing people during one of the deadliest pandemics in history. South Africa is the African country hardest hit by COVID-19 with almost 3 million cases and about 84,000 deaths. Darren Taylor reports.
The South African Committee of Health Sciences Deans is on a long list of organizations that want citizens to in effect be forced to take the jab. Chairman Professor Tian de Jager says there's enough scientific evidence to prove the vaccines are safe and effective. He says the state should start with mandatory vaccinations in any and all healthcare facilities.
It is critical to get students, doctors, any staff working in a health setting vaccinated to make sure that we not putting the patients at risk or anybody in any environment.
Calls such as the Jagers come on the back of research by one of South Africa's biggest public hospitals, Groote Schuur in Cape Town. Operations Chief for the Health Department, Dr. Sadiq Karim, says the study concentrated on patients admitted with serious COVID-19.
On the day that they did the survey, of the 156 people admitted to Groote Schuur Hospital with COVID, in fact, they found that 153 people were unvaccinated. Of those who were admitted into the intensive care, of the 66, they found that all of them were in fact unvaccinated. Of the 32 people on ventilators, all of them were again unvaccinated. So I think it sends a really important, really powerful message.
But the anti-vaxxers have dismissed the study as lies and continue to encourage people not to take vaccines. Their reasons for doing so include that COVID-19 is a hoax designed to enrich pharmaceutical companies and that vaccines make people infertile. The anti-vaxxer movement is particularly strong in the Western Cape province, where Karim's based.
I mean, as medical practitioners, we are obviously equally frustrated in the province that people just don't listen to the science of it, that they believe all kinds of conspiracy theories, and a lot of that misinformation can be combated, and that's why the colleagues from Groote Schuur Hospital, in fact, put out that graphic that so visibly displays to people and proves to people what the benefits of vaccination are.
De Jager says those refusing to be immunized have no excuse for their stance because it's not based on scientific evidence and is extremely selfish.
We need to do the responsible thing. If you're not vaccinated and you go to the doctors, obviously you're at higher risk and the chances are much bigger to expose everybody within that practice. And it is basically a measurement to protect other patients as well as the doctor and the healthcare workers working in that facility.
But Karim says the anti-vaxxers won't listen to doctors like him and De Jager because they consider them to be part of the so-called conspiracy. So his department is trying to overcome vaccine hesitancy in other ways.
Whether they be community leaders or whether they be religious leaders, we've been using trusted voices to try and get the scientific message across to people, because it's quite clear that as medical practitioners, we are not having the impact that we would have desired and wanted to have.
The government says at this stage it won't force anyone to take the jab, and it remains the right of every citizen to choose whether to be vaccinated. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The World Health Organization says an epidemic of meningitis has been declared in the DRC's northeast. The French news agency AFP says the government has deployed an initial emergency team and the WHO is bringing in additional drugs and experts. So far, 261 suspected cases have been recorded, including 129 fatalities. Meningitis is an infection of the lining surrounding the brain and spinal cord, transmitted through respiratory droplets of throat secretions from those infected. Without treatment, it can cause neurological damage, especially deafness and mental retardation among young children. With new COVID-19 cases gradually decreasing in Zimbabwe and the economy and schools reopening, the government is further easing lockdown restrictions. Reporter Kudzai Zenwashi has the details.
President Emmerson Mnangagwa announced the revised measures on state television yesterday.
Fellow Zimbabweans, the last 2 weeks have seen our nation record a further marked reduction in new COVID-19 cases. I'm therefore introducing a relaxation of the current level 4 lockdown to level 2 lockdown.
That includes easing the curfew from 10 p.m. to 5:30 a.m., allowing intercity travel, public gatherings of up to 100 people, and low-risk sports. and expanding opening hours for businesses, restaurants and bars within hotels and lodges and liquor sales. Munyara Dzidodo is an analyst. He tells VOA the new measures will be widely welcome in the arts sector.
I think it's good that events can now happen with 100 people and that intercity travel can happen. I think a lot of artists will welcome that and will hope that more easing will happen in the next 2 weeks so that the artists in Zimbabwe can have a chance to actually make money. They've been under lockdown for nearly a year now and haven't had income from their craft coming through. So this will go a long way in maybe easing their burden.
Harare resident Diana Chipere explains how the new measures will ease the burden on her daily routine.
It's a very good move. It makes a lot of sense because before we were finishing work at 3 o'clock and the stores were closing at the same time. So you don't really have time to go to the store and do the things that you need to do. And I think that even like exacerbates numbers because now everybody's rushing to the store at the same time before it closes.
While the revisions have been widely welcomed, some think they could have been introduced earlier. The public is also being told to continue masking up, sanitizing, and social distancing to avoid another spike of coronavirus cases and a likely return of tighter measures. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
Somalia's President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed and Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble are locked in a deepening standoff that threatens to set off a full-blown political crisis in an already unstable country. According to the French news agency AFP, the standoff started when Roble accused Mohamed, better known as Farmajo, of obstructing a high-profile investigation into the disappearance of a 25-year-old intelligence agent, Ikran Tahlil. She was abducted near her home in Mogadishu in June. Last week, her employers concluded that she had been kidnapped and killed by Al-Shabaab jihadists. Al-Shabaab promptly and unusually issued a denial, while Tahlil's family accused Somalia's security agency of killing her. Roble reacted by firing the security director, who was reinstated the next day by the president. A new report says at least 7 in 10 Ugandans say their government is performing fairly badly or very badly in combating corruption. Reporter Mugume Davis Rawakaringi has more from Kampala, Uganda.
The report by Afrobarometer, an East Africa-based survey research network, says 77% of those surveyed believe that people who report corruption to authorities risk retaliation or other negative consequences. It also found out that government bodies such as the Inspector General of Government's Office and the State House Anti-Corruption Unit have not persuaded the public that the level of corruption is decreasing. Francis Chibirige is the coordinator of Afrobarometer Research Network in Uganda.
The survey does show that a large majority of Ugandans, up to 62%, perceive corruption to have increased during the previous year, 2019, in Uganda. And up to 82% say that government is performing poorly in its fight against corruption. This very perception was 52% in our 2012 survey.
At least 50% of Ugandans believe that an ordinary person cannot do much in fighting corruption. Kibirige says Afrobarometer interviewed 1,200 adults between 30th September and 31st October 2019 and 2,400 adults between 22nd December 2020 and 7th January 2021 across the country. Sise Kagaba, who heads local NGO Anti-Corruption Coalition, told VOA she wasn't surprised with the findings.
Because over time we've seen the levels of corruption within the country going up, and hardly any tangible action, despite the fact that we have a robust legal and institutional framework. Obviously, it does not reflect well on the current government because we've seen the president come out on a number of occasions and continuously reiterate his government's commitment to fight corruption. But we need to know that people have become very apathetic, whereby they don't really think any action is going to be taken against especially those that are involved in grand corruption schemes.
Chris Bajomunsi, the government spokesperson, welcomed the findings. He told VOA that they help the government know citizens' perceptions on the fight against corruption.
But definitely it's not true that the government of Uganda is not serious. We are serious when it comes to the issue of fighting corruption. Our policy as a government is zero tolerance to corruption. We have put in place institutions to fight corruption, ranging from the Inspector General of Government, the Auditor General, the Anti-Corruption Court, the Accountability Committees of Parliament.
The survey recommended adding enough staffing in the public domain to reduce backlogs and using online services to avoid person-to-person contacts when citizens are paying for services. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Blockchain data platform Chain Analysis has ranked internet-using Kenyans as the world's top peer-to-peer cryptocurrency traders. The group's survey shows that many Kenyans use P2P cryptocurrency trading because they do not have access to centralized exchanges. Lenny Ruvaga looks at the challenges and what it means for the industry in Kenya.
Tony Mongera is the CEO of Healthland Spa. Today, Mongera is going over the books of accounts. For the last 5 years, Mongera has been a pioneer in accepting cryptocurrencies as a means of paying for services at his establishment. On average, services at the spa cost around $30, which according to Mongera can be paid through Bitcoin. Mongera says that introducing Bitcoin as a means of payment has proven quite popular with his clients.
Many customers are also saying that we are accepting Bitcoin. It is a modern form of payment. And that they said, where do they come? They can enjoy our massage services and pay using Bitcoin because it's safe, secure, and also very convenient.
A recently released report by Chain Analysis ranks Kenya as a leader in peer-to-peer trading of cryptocurrencies. One of the major parameters used in the Global Crypto Adoption Index was the number of cryptocurrency deposits and number of internet users. Mongera says clients have to download a blockchain wallet to enable payment. He explains the steps on how payment through cryptocurrencies is processed.
In your blockchain wallet, you put $30, it converts into Bitcoin. Once it converts, now you send to me, then I receive. When I receive the payment, now you're good to go. You can now leave after doing the massage services.
David Gitonga is the co-founder of Bitcoin KE, an organization that was begun 3 years ago and whose aim is to facilitate peer-to-peer trading, including the education of users on blockchain technology and cryptocurrencies. On average, Bitcoin KE brings together around 70,000 visitors to its platform daily. Gitonga says that most peer-to-peer trading occurs due to the aspect of anonymity.
In Kenya, peer-to-peer is actually the easiest way for people to get into cryptocurrencies. So right now, there are no centralized exchanges. So most people opt to go the peer-to-peer way. So these exchanges are not controlled locally, for example. They cannot be shut down. So it's much easier for people to just transact between each other.
Michael Kimani is a blockchain analyst from PESA Africa, an organization that monitors cryptocurrencies worldwide with a focus on Africa. Kimani says that the fact that cryptocurrencies are unregulated by a central authority could pose a big challenge.
The central bank issue that has prevented companies or startups from building in Kenya. So it's made it really difficult for Kenyans to have formal channels of accessing cryptocurrencies. And this has created the proliferation of things like cryptocurrency scams. So one of the reasons the peer-to-peer volumes are going up in Kenya is because there are no formal channels, and the only way you can buy is through the peer-to-peer marketplaces and channels.
Mongera can only hope that his choice to add cryptocurrencies as a means of payment will keep attracting more clientele to his growing business. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baruch, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.